A topic like this obviously needs needs a bit of a pushing just to even think about discussing it. So just before we do anything, just wanted to say thank you to Yitz Inker for sort of encouraging us to take this topic on and do something with it. I think he was very correct when he was discussing with me and a little bit with Rev Orlean the importance of speaking about these topics. And this is we're tonight the night before Shivasar B'Tammuz, which of course is the beginning of the 3 weeks period, which deals with the national mourning, as we mentioned on the posting, the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, etc., etc. And it seemed to be a good time of year to discuss at least briefly some of the issues related to our personal mourning as well. Rachmana Litzlan, it shouldn't happen, but for those of us that have been in the situation and can, shouldn't happen, but at some point if anybody would be in the future, it's important to have at least a little bit of a basis for what goes on and what some of the issues are. Some of them are connected to the 3 weeks and the 9 days and Tisha B'Av, and you'll notice over the next couple of weeks that some of the issues really are somewhat parallel, maybe not completely, but at least somewhat parallel. You'll see the connections there. But even just for its own sake, it's a very, very difficult topic, obviously, to talk about. Number one, because some of you mentioned, and my wife was discussing with me about, I think it's like an ayin hara, that you can't talk about this issue, because God forbid you don't want that to be seen in Shemaim as, well, you know, you're asking for it. God forbid something should happen, if somebody should pass away. In all my research for this and my studies in Smicha and any other time I've learned this topic, I have not yet found in a major mainstream source the idea that you shouldn't study this topic because of something like an ayin hara. So again, if anybody's familiar with that, you could mention it to me, but personally I don't think that that's a factor in not studying it. I think that unfortunately we've seen many times that when God forbid somebody passes away and really we're sort of caught in the dark and we don't know what to do, we don't know where to turn, emotionally we're shell-shocked, and at least to get some sort of guidance, to have some idea of what's supposed to be going on from a Torah perspective, sometimes is at least the beginning of a little bit of comfort. And again, this is obviously just difficult to deal with because it's so emotional. And I think this is my introduction before we start discussing some of the issues. I think you have to look at this in two different ways, and they really complement each other, and at the same time, you can split them. Number one is that I think that this is a good opportunity, at least most of us are not right in the middle of Avelus, again with some exceptions obviously, Gary. But in general, it's important to take a step back and deal with these topics at a time that you're not right in the middle of having to deal with this, because at that point, it's not that it's too late, but it's very difficult to have everything on you all at once, and because of your emotional state, it's very difficult to sit and actually think about the halachic and other philosophical and Torah come up. One, that's, I think it's important to take a step back and be able to deal with this at a separate time. Number two, on the other side, it's very difficult in the halacha and in the hashkafa to separate the idea of discussing the laws of mourning from the emotions and everything that goes into it at the time that you're actually in avil. Hey, when we sit, and those of us that have learned this, you know, at other times in smicha, whatever, okay, this is like a nice gemara learning. You learn the gemara in moed katan and brachos. Okay, somebody died, and you have to know, what do I do next? And how do I do for avelus? And how do I bury him? And this and this and that. And in your mind, it's all just, you know, conceptual. Okay, this is very nice. I love this learning. I love learning gemara. I love learning daf yomi psachim. I love learning about people that, you know, about avelus. And it's just all the same thing. And in these areas, the halacha really has a lot to say for at the time that we are in emotional shell shock, and to put the concepts together and really be able to feel the power of the Torah and the power of the messages that we see from the halacha, I think is especially powerful on the second side, when dealt with really in the context of that emotional state, which, and we hope to never have to feel, but, you know, if we feel it, you can sort of feel that the comfort, if you've gone through this a little bit, the comfort of the halacha really is there if it's conveyed properly, if it's learned properly, and if you have a rabbinic mentor to guide you a little bit along the way to explain how the halacha develops. And I'll be mentioning both tonight a little bit and also as we go on, my father, in his book, really, this is one of his key points that he deals with, maybe even a little more than some of the other books, how the halacha really does speak to the psychological state and the mental state of the mourners. Is really geared towards bringing them and guiding them along the way to be mainstream back into the community, and also to be able to deal with the emotions and the feelings of your world came crashing down on you. Everything is gone. I feel horrible. I feel like I can't go on living, etc., etc. And the halacha is really there to pull you out slowly, slowly, to bring you back and deal with the feelings and try to figure out, well, how do I move on and how do I feel like God is still with me, even though I feel that maybe he left. That's just a little bit of an introduction to be thinking about when we go through some of these halachas, again, both on the non-emotional side as well as with a little bit of the emotion put in. Any other comments before we go on to some of the actual issues that I wanted to talk about tonight? Okay. But again, feel free, even though the topic is obviously a bit sensitive, feel free to, if you have questions or comments along the way, feel free to speak up. So I wanted to talk about three or four things tonight, which I mentioned on the posting. The first thing we're going to talk about is the halachos of aninus. This is the major halachic issue that comes up, after, God forbid, a relative dies. Once we've done a little bit of the halachic issues of aninus, of understanding what you're obligated to do or not obligated to do during that time in terms of mitzvos, so then we'll talk a little bit about some of the other issues of just practically when, God forbid, somebody passes away, well, what do you do with the body, with the shmira, which watching the body, calling the chevra kedisha, any other kinds of customs that come along, we'll deal with that a little bit, and then afterwards we'll maybe spend a few minutes talking about other issues to be aware of, not as the Avel, but as maybe somebody who's supporting the Avel, close family, friends, etc., etc., things that you can be aware of that can maybe help you at that time to help them. And number four, just a few words about cremation, in terms of how to deal with that. Again, shouldn't be in that situation, but for those that have been or those that maybe at some point, again, it's unfortunately becoming a little bit more common these days, especially in Chutz Laaretz, but unfortunately even here in Eretz Yisrael, it's getting out there, and it's helpful to have at least a few thoughts to understand where the Torah's perspective comes from, and a little bit of some guidelines about what to do if somebody's thinking about it, what you can say to them, and how to deal with it if they have already decided to go that route. Okay, so let's start with a little bit of aninus. What exactly is aninus? So an onen is the term that's used to describe the state of a person whose relative died. Again, relatives, we're talking about what we call the shiva krovim, okay, parents, children, God forbid, brothers, sisters, again, those that group of relatives that you would be, you know, in avelus for. In onen, again, the word onen is also interesting in terms of its origins. My father actually speaks about this a little bit as well, and he, others as well, identify onen with a few different aspects, which I'll just mention two of right now. Number one, onen may be related to the word ana, which is like a plea, like a calling out to God, as well as the idea of an, like li'an, to where, like where am I going? And those, among other types of explanations that maybe identify a little bit with the idea of a cry, really accurately identify the emotional state of a person who's in aninus. They're a person that has no direction. They don't know, where am I going? My whole world is gone. God forbid, whoever it is that passed away, I feel like I should be up in Shemayim right now. I don't belong here. I cry out to God, what am I doing here? Why did you do this to me, God? You have this emotional feeling of anger and uncertainty and everything altogether. Rav Soloveitchik had an interesting comment about this. Again, this may speak to some of you, may not speak to some of you, but just his language is so graphic. He says, Anina represents the spontaneous human reaction to death. It is an outcry, a shout, or a howl of grisly horror and disgust. Man responds to his defeat at the hands of death with total resignation and with an all-consuming, masochistic, self-devastating black despair. Beaten by the fiend, his prayers rejected, enveloped by a hideous darkness, forsaken and lonely, man begins to question his own human singular reality. Doubt develops quickly into a cruel conviction, and doubting man turns to mocking man. So again, this may speak to you or may not speak to you, but some of the ideas here certainly capture the picture of how you feel in the period of aninus, just not knowing where you're going, and just everything is horrible and crying. It's just so many different emotions together. And part of the idea of aninus in the halachic sense really response to this. If you look at source number one on the sheet, so this is the famous source in the Mishnah for the halachos of aninus. It says here in source number one, Misha Mesa Mutalafanov, Mishnah on Brachos, the beginning of the third parak, somebody who's dead is in front of him. Pater mikriyashma uminatzfila uminatzfilin umikol mitzvos ha'amuras b'torah. He's exempt from reciting kriyashma, from tzfila, from davening, from wearing tzfilin, and from all mitzvos that are mentioned in the Torah. So the first point to make here is that this is discussed in the Gemara, but the conclusion is this doesn't necessarily only refer to somebody who has the body of the relative right in front of them at that moment. This refers, according to the conclusion, to anybody who is in the status of aninus, who has a relative that he is helping to care for. Even if it's not right in front of you, it's somewhere else, it's down the block, it's 10 minutes away, whatever it is. Again, we'll discuss the details shortly. But the idea is that you are part of the team of people that is responsible for trying to give this person a proper kvura. That's the idea of Misha Mesa Mutalafanav. It's in front of you, not only literally, but even figuratively. It's on your shoulders to help and move the process along to bury him. So based on that, the halacha is generally speaking that most people that are in onen in this state are exempt from mitzvos. Now, what mitzvos are we talking about here? So, right, good. So basically it's positive mitzvos. Mitzvos ase. Right. It's basically mitzvos ase. Okay. Mitzvos lo tase. Negative mitzvos are not included in this exemption. Okay. Violating Shabbos for lo tase for negative things, eating treif, any other kinds of negative mitzvos that we don't allow you to do in general, there is no free pass during the period of aninus. This is all for positive mitzvos. So again, for example, we'll just take regular day-to-day mitzvos. So basically brachas, what'd you say? Right, all the brachas. So washing is actually interesting. I won't get into the details now. The Achronim will talk about that. For washing, what they actually say is that because there's also a prohibition to not eat without washing your hands for bread, so they say that it's best to actually wash your hands, but not to make a bracha. That's the conclusion that's generally followed. Again, other brachas should not be said. Again, we mentioned here also Shema and Tefillin and other kinds of positive mitzvahs like that. You can think of a few more, I'm sure. Any of those kinds of things are going to be included in this type of pitur. One more point before, if you have other questions, and that is that I just mentioned very quickly: is this a pitur? Is it an exemption, or is it a prohibition to do it? So that's also actually a machlokas in the commentaries between Rashi and Tosfos and others. The bottom line halacha, I did not quote it on the sheet here, but the bottom line halacha on the Shulchan Aruch follows the opinions that say that you're actually forbidden to do these mitzvos, meaning not just that you're exempt from saying brachas and davening and et cetera, but you're not allowed to. So again, if you go back, before we get to the particular reasons, which there are, but just in the overall picture of aninus, based on how we were describing it before, we can actually see how this actually fits in very, very nicely. And my father discusses this a little bit, as does Rav Soloveitchik, and I think the other books maybe do also, but especially here, they point out that this really sort of identifies with your emotions. When you're in the status of thinking of being angry at God, so to speak, for what he did. When you're in the staff, just, you can't deal with life because your mind is in death. So, how can you possibly get up and say, brachas, thank you Hashem for giving me life. Thank you Hashem for giving me food to eat. It's just, that's not where your mind is right then. So, the way that the philosophy goes according to this is that the Torah understands that, and the Torah identifies with that. And therefore the Torah says, this is not the time for you to be doing positive mitzvos. Your mind is not there. The Torah is a Torah of life. The Chai Bohem. We live with them. It's Chayim He. And right now, if you are preoccupied with death, then we understand that, and we will let you temporarily, until after the burial, put the positive mitzvos on the side and be able to totally deal with your feelings, working through them, and as well, we'll see in a minute, working through some of the practical arrangements for the funeral. Yeah.
So is this only if a person is actually responsible for the burial?
So we'll get to that. Okay, just give me a few more minutes. Okay, don't worry. I wasn't going to...
I think, let's say, for example, a person's in extra unfortunately, someone's been... You know, they're going to be buried overseas before the person even travels there.
Right.
So they're not responsible in any way.
Right.
So do they still...
So we'll just go... We'll get to that. Yeah. Okay,
bleed matter. What about the positive Shabbat?
So that's also... So Shabbos is actually different. I don't think I put it on the sheet here. But in the same Mishnah and in the Shulchan Aruch as well, Shabbos is actually the exception. Okay, Shabbos is a time that the rules of aninus in general do not apply, at least the public rules of aninus do not apply, and therefore the general mitzvahs we were talking about right now and all the positive mitzvahs of Shabbos, of Kiddush and Hamotzi and etc., those mitzvahs you do. You have to do them. What'd you say? Yeah, correct. All those mitzvahs are done on Shabbos. This is all during the week. Part of the reason for that, as we'll say right now, is based on the logic behind this. So the specific logic that we usually use, in addition to the general philosophical idea that I was just discussing, is in source number 2. This is Rashi. Again, there are a few other explanations as well, but this is really the main one that we usually work with. Rashi says here in source number 2, Lefishu Torah Machshavas Kfuraso. Because the person is busy, is tarud is really a word which means more than busy. It's really like enveloped. It's totally encompassed. You're totally totally busy dealing with that. Machshavas kfura, so with the thoughts and the arrangements of the burial. So according to this, again, this is generally how we hold more or less. Again, there are a few other explanations as well. But the idea is that your mind is somewhere else. As long as your mind is busy with the arrangements, therefore you are not only exempt, but even not allowed to go forward and do any of these mitzvos. That's part of the reason, at least, why on Shabbos it's allowed, because on Shabbos you're not supposed to be making any arrangements for the funeral. That's part of the idea here.
Another question. Let's say a person, they're out of contact, and they only hear about it, either during the week of Shiva or even after the Shiva has finished, because they're completely out of contact. Does the halachos of Anina still apply in that case?
Okay, so we'll get to that again. Again, your question is if they don't even know about it, or?
Yeah.
Okay, so they for sure can't be on Anina when the person is not yet buried, in that case, because they didn't know about it yet. You're talking about...
Yeah, but don't they anyway still have to sit Shiva for a day?
They have to do something, like correct, correct.
So from the time that they hear to the time that they sit Shiva, is there still Aninus then?
Not really. Again, that's not so common these days anymore. It was common more in the olden days. Today, people know about everything within, a few minutes of email and phone and this and that. I think it's pretty uncommon that type of thing happens unless somebody is, elderly and can't deal with the information, and therefore maybe we would withhold the information from them because they can't physically or mentally deal with it at that point. That may be, a relevant case. More than that, I don't know. If you've heard about cases like that, I'd be interested to hear. But the halachas, that's called there's two concepts called Shmua Krova and Shmua Rechoka, which are basically that you heard about it later, either within a month or after a month, and the halachas may be different for either one, but that period of aninus generally would not apply in those cases. You basically would sit Shiva for either 7 days if it's during the first month, and maybe one day after that, if it was after the first month. But that's the aninus generally would not be relevant then. Okay. In terms of Shabbos, which we mentioned before, the real question now is the following: this is what you mentioned already. What do you do in cases where the kavura, the burial, is not really your responsibility? Okay, meaning that somebody else is taking care of the actual burial and the arrangements for the burial. So here, it's interesting, there's a development in the halakha, which we're not going to go through in detail, but just so you could see here, in source number 3, so if you look at the Shulchan Aruch and Siv Gimel, so the Shulchan Aruch here says the following, Makom shenoagim shetefayim yuchadim lotzi ameis, in a place where the custom is that they have specific groups of people that take out the mace and basically arrange for his burial, take him away and bring him to, so to speak, what we call the Levaya, they bring him there, and after basically after the relatives have finished their end of the preparations before, and then they're going to give it over to this group of people and they're going to bury them, at the point when the relatives have given over the body to this group, then that's another point I forgot to mention before. One of the other prohibitions for aninus is that you're not allowed to drink wine and have meat. So at this point, once they've given the body over to the group, so then they're actually permitted. Because if you skip a line to the end, there are shuv ein mutal aleihem. At the point, it's already not their responsibility anymore to take care of the mace. Now, before we go into the development of that, of how it gets to modern times, just two other halachas that are actually one other halacha that comes afterwards here. In Sif Hey, this goes back to the question of what else are you not allowed to do during the period of Aninus. But since it's here, so I'll mention it, that's why I'm mentioning it now. In addition to the prohibitions of not doing mitzvos, we see here also, kolzman shlo nikbar ha-meis eino cholet min al v'sandal. You're not allowed, as long as the person hasn't been buried. So the Shulchan Aruch says that you don't take off your shoes. Now again, that's also a discussion. The bottom line we pass it like this, meaning that the custom is we don't take off our shoes, we don't take off our leather shoes before the burial. Even though, as we'll see in a minute, that may not be true for other things. Look at the Ramah here, Haga. The Chol Shekhen She'asar B'tashra Shamita. The Ramah says that having relations with your husband or wife is not allowed. V'yesh Omrim De'asar B'rachitza V'sicha V'simcha V'she'el HaShalom V'tisporas V'malacha. Some say that you're also not allowed to bathe. You're not also not allowed to anoint, meaning to put creams on. Simcha, to do things of enjoyment. Again, music, things like that. She'el HaShalom, greetings. Tisporas, haircuts, shaving, uvumalacha, and going to work is also not allowed. So here the concept is that according to this opinion, this is how we paskin, at least for Ashkenazim, we certainly paskin this way. Sfardim, actually, to us, I don't remember if the Sfardim hold like this or not. But the Ashkenazim definitely paskin this way, that that all the aspects of Avelus itself, after when you're in mourning, also apply to the period of Anivus. Okay, that's the general rule. The exceptions to the rule are what we said before about shoes. Number two, we don't sit down on the floor when you're in Onin. And number three, the next line there where it says, Aval mutar l'tzeis min pesach beis, so you're allowed to leave your house. Okay, those aspects are permitted when you're in Onin, and anybody can figure out why. What'd you say?
And basar b'yayin?
No. So basar b'yayin is not allowed. Okay. That's only allowed after you've given it over. That's what we'll get back to in a second. Or on Shabbos.
So
but
you give it over.
What would you say? He just has that, the meat and the wine. So again, normally you're not allowed to drink meat and drink wine and eat meat when you're in Onin, except if it's Shabbos, or if you're again not involved, which we'll get to in a second, if you're not involved in the preparations at all.
Shoes leaving the house
and sitting on the ground are the three main ones. The idea between of all three of them is that basically they may get in the way of your effective arrangement for the Levaya and the Kfura. Okay, those are all things which, if you keep them, again, this is, seems to be the idea. It's not so clear, but bottom line, it seems to be this is how the commentaries understand it, that those three things will get in the way, and we need you to be able to do as effectively as possible everything in order to organize the kfura.
So you can't have meat and wine until the body is handed over.
Correct.
Once it's handed over, you can have meat and wine until the levaya, which you then can't again.
No, so during Shiva you're also allowed to.
You're allowed to.
Yeah. So that's not this week. That'll be in 2 weeks, God willing. We'll talk about a little bit of the rules of Shiva and the Beis Avel. But that you're actually allowed to. Yeah. Okay. You're allowed to keep your shoes on. Meaning, again, there is a discussion. Some opinions say not like that, but the bottom line, the halacha, we follow what the Shulchan Aruch says here, which is basically that you can keep your shoes on during that time, because again, it's difficult to otherwise to prepare. And again, as long as the rules of Aninus apply, so then you have you don't have to worry about that. Yeah. But this is the same rule of shoes as you would have during Shiva.
You can wear other shoes.
Correct. Yeah. The same rules as during Shiva of not wearing whatever shoes, which are generally leather or, again, other shoes is a discussion, but at least leather shoes, that's what we're talking about here as well. Yeah. Okay. So the next point, just to get back to where we were before, is whatever the rules, all these rules, so again, how do they apply if you're not directly involved in the arrangements? So here, basically, again, we saw the Shulchan Aruch before in Siv Gimel, who basically said that once you give it over to this group, so then the halacha is that, that you don't have to keep it anymore. If you look at source number 4, though, the Pisrei Tshuva, which is one of the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, so he quotes from the Notab Yehuda, that's the Nun Vav Bet there, is the Notab Yehuda of Yecheskel Landau. So he says the following. The Tshuva Notab Yehuda, Tanina, with one of the versions, Kazav Shom Shechorech Lomar, the Hadinim Salak Seifai Mahani, the case that the Shulchan Aruch was talking about, Hainu B'makam Shemalichin Hames, L'makom rachav. That's only true in a case where they're bringing the mace to a faraway place to be buried. The ain onen holichim ayim, and the onen is not going with them. But if the relatives are still going with them, meaning they've given over the body to the chaver kaddisha, but they are planning on being part of the levaya and having a funeral service wherever it is, and then part of the procession to the cemetery, etc., etc., then the halacha is lo mahani misira. Then he feels that's not a good enough reason to get rid of the halachas of aninus, meaning you would still be subject to the rules of an onain even after the body has been taken away before the kura. That's what he says there. And therefore, again, we're not going to read the rest of it inside, but he basically says, if you want to look at it, he basically says in his area, what they did is that the onanim, even though they gave away the body to the chaver kaddisha, basically, they were not able to daven until after the kura. Okay, meaning they were still putter and they were not allowed to daven before that point. Okay, same idea, meaning essentially what he's saying is like this. And you see the last line there, he says, the Chachmas Adam, who's one of the other Achronim, the author of the Chaya Adam, he disagrees. He actually held otherwise, but we generally follow the opinion of the Notab Yehuda. So how does that play itself out practically? So essentially what this would mean is the following. Essentially what it means is that, assuming that you are, again, let's take a case right now where you are involved in the arrangements, okay? Meaning you are around when the person dies, you're nearby, you're part of the arrangements for the funeral, you gave over the body to the Chaver Kaddisha, but you're still there. You're still heavily involved in the rest of the arrangements. Okay, even if you're not actually part of the taking the body and the Shmira and the Tahara, etc., etc. So generally speaking, the more or less generally accepted halacha by most is that you would still be subject to the rules of Aninus. Okay, that's the general application of this, which again, there may be some exceptions, which we'll get to in a second, which you mentioned before, but the general rule is assuming that you're there when the person passes away and you're still involved in all the arrangements in some way, then even if the Chevra Kedisha has taken the body, then assuming you're going to the Levaya, then the halacha would be that you're still an Onim. The question then becomes, and we're not going to spend a lot of time on this now, but the question really is more serious when it comes to, let's say, where you're somewhere totally different, okay? If you are not at all involved in the arrangements because, let's say, that you are here in Eretz Yisrael, and the person, the relative dies, God forbid, in Chutz La'aretz, or the other way around, that may be more of a discussion. Okay? So let's say if you are not going to the Levaya at all, and you are, let's say, in a different country, let's say that would be the case. So then already, the rules of Anidas may not apply, and you actually may start the rules of Shiva much earlier than everybody else. Again, this we're not going to deal with now, we'll deal with this either next week or the week afterwards. But the rules of Shiva actually may start early if you're not actually going to the Levaya.
Okay. Before the Levaya. Yeah.
Correct, yes. Again, that's a whole discussion. This is really a longer discussion, but in theory, that's what may happen in many cases. Okay. If the case is such, let's say the following case. Let's say that you are, again, this is not so true for us, but let's say the people that are involved are in Chutz La'aretz. Okay. We'll take the United States just for argument's sake. Okay. God forbid somebody passes away. And you are there, and they are sending the body here to Eretz Yisrael for kavura. Let's say that, you know, many of the people are not going to the Levaya in Eretz Yisrael. They're not going along with the mace. So in that case, once the body has been given over at the terminal, let's say at JFK, for example, and then that's it, they're going back home. So that's what we mentioned before, that the Shiva might already start then, but in terms of Aninus, you're already, then you're finished. You're finished with Aninus, because at that point, you are no longer involved in anything. Okay, you're no longer involved in bringing the mace, and you're no longer involved even in the arrangements, okay? But if you're still involved in the arrangements and you're going to the Levaya, even if you're not there at the time, but let's say you are somewhere 3 hours away, okay? Or you are, you know, across the ocean or across the country, whatever it is, but you're involved in making the arrangements. You're involved, you're on the phone with your siblings. You're on the phone with the funeral director, and you're on the phone with the Chevra Kedisha, or at least coordinating, you know, who's going to speak at the Levaya, all these kinds of things, etc., etc. So again, this is a bit of a debate, but the bottom line is that many posts can hold that in that case as well, you would be subject to the rules of Anius. Okay? As long as you are involved in some way with the give and take of what's going on, then many posts would hold that you would be subject to the rules of Anius. The case that you would not be subject to the rules of Aninus would be a situation where even, let's say, again, this is also a discussion, if you're not involved at all in the organization, then maybe you wouldn't be subject to the rules of Aninus. So this, if you don't mind, if I take your case, Jonathan, this may be an interesting example. Again, what happened to Naomi. So, again, this doesn't always happen this way, but let's say that you're here in Eretz Yisrael, and somebody, God forbid, dies in Chutz La'aretz, and they're bringing the kavura here to Eretz Yisrael, the base is going to be buried here, but you're not involved in the arrangements at all because somebody else took care of it completely. Or the other way around, you're here, and the Levaya is there, and you're going there for the Levaya, but you're not at all involved in the arrangements. Everybody else is taking care of it, you're just going, but you're not involved. So there already, some poskim would say that as long as you're not involved, you wouldn't be subject to aninus, except, I think if I remember in your case, what happened, at least the psak that you got, maybe that if you are going to the Levaya, when you get to the place which is close to the Levaya, maybe at that point it could be that you can actually begin to be an Onan at that point. So let's say in your case, when the body's coming here, so if you're here and the body's coming here, so when the body gets to Eretz Yisrael, then maybe you would be subject to the rules of Aninus, because at that point maybe you do have to figure out, you know, what's going on. But if you weren't all involved in the arrangements, or let's say the other direction, if you're going to Chutz La'aretz and you're not involved in arrangements, when you get there, then you are going to be accompanying the mace to the funeral and to the cemetery. So at that point, you may be subject to the rules of Aninus, even if when you were here beforehand, maybe you wouldn't be. But again, that depends on the details. And I guess the main point here, I would just suggest, the main point is that there may be some nuances in a lot of these cases. It's always worthwhile. These are the cases where it's very important to be in touch with a Rav, or Posek, who can guide you based on your specific situation and exactly what you should be doing. Okay? That's really the most important point, because as you can see, it's not so clear. And in some of these cases, there may be different opinions. I gave you, you know, some more of the consensus opinions, but there may be different opinions. It's always kedai to check out the situation with the Rav that you're speaking to, and get a psak about exactly whether you should be observing Aninus or not, and if so, for how long, and until what point, etc., etc. Yeah.
So, at the point when Aninus stops, either because the body's been handed over or it's been buried, at that point, does a person become chayav for Kriya Shema Tefillah and for Tefillah for the day?
Good. So that's
the first thing that they have to do, basically.
So that's a whole discussion, and Would you say? Yeah. It, correct, right. So, yeah, you can tell us if you're willing to.
No, because the funeral ended at like 2 in the afternoon, 3 in the afternoon. So there is, like after the time of the spot, for example, which you can read it.
Right.
Just not, you know, like.
It's not as Montcrashman anymore. Yeah. Right. So basically, right.
And there's also an interesting thing, well, interesting, plus there was the first footage. So there's Musa. So.
All day. Yeah.
Basically,
any mitzvah that you're still, that the obligation is still continuing at the time after the funeral is over, then at that point you would do those mitzvahs. Okay, you would daven, let's say if you're in the middle of mincha
very
time, you would do
to
daven mincha.
That the rabbi that we're talking about, very important to have him involved.
In everything, for sure. And I'm going to get back to this again. Don't worry. Yeah.
Now it's 2 o'clock.
I was gonna get to that again afterwards, but on all these aspects, very, very important. And my father discusses this a few other ways as well, which I'll get to in a few minutes. But again, anything which is still obligatory at that moment after the levaya is finished, then you need to daven that. But anything that passed already, let's say if it's afternoon time for shacharis, again, this is a discussion in the poskim, but the bottom line is we generally, you know, would not make it up if it already finished. Again, there are some details here that have to be discussed, which we don't really have time for now, but that's basically the discussion. The two points I would just mention briefly. Number one is tefillin may be different. Meaning tefillin, the halacha is that we do not put on tefillin the whole first day after the day of the kvura. Okay, and this is also in the Shulchan Aruch. I didn't put it in the sheet here, but it's there in the Shulchan Aruch based on the Rishonim is a whole discussion. But basically, we generally pass in that the day of the kvura in most situations, the day of the kvura you wouldn't put on tefillin the rest of the day. Okay, then only the psak. The other aspect also is let's say havdalah. Okay. Let's say if you have not made Havdalah, let's say the Levaya, the person died, God forbid, on Friday, and the funeral is on Sunday. So you don't make Havdalah after Shabbos, because it's a positive mitzvah, and it's not Shabbos anymore. The question is, do you make Havdalah on Sunday afternoon or Monday afternoon? And again, this is a whole discussion, but the bottom line, halacha is generally speaking, usually the answer is yes. That because the time of Havdalah can last until Tuesday,
you can eat.
Yeah, that's a not a serious prohibition. What'd you say?
So
the Nair already, again, that's the halacha of Havdalah. The Nair is not done after Saturday night. So Saturday night, you're not going to do the Nair because that's a positive mitzvah. Once it comes to Sunday already, there's no mitzvah. The Nair already is finished. And the Besamim as well. Those are done. Those are only for Saturday night. That's true any other time as well, even if you're not an Avel. If for some reason you didn't get to Havdalah and it's a Shabbos for whatever reason, and you do it Sunday morning, then you wouldn't do the Nair or the Havdalah either. Okay, let's go on. We don't have so much time left. So the second point I just wanted to discuss a little bit is some of the other directions of what to do after a person passes away. Again, aninus is really the main halachic aspect, but the other aspects that come up again are also important, and these are the ones that you really also really, really need the help and the guidance of a Rav, wherever it may be. Again, if you're here, we're in Chutz Laaretz, wherever it is, the Rav is very important, number one, to give you some of the guidelines halachically and hashkafically, and also to give you a sense of what the minhag ha-makom is, what the custom in the place, because there are, for other aspects of what to do with the mace, there are many different customs in different places, and generally speaking, you're supposed to follow the custom of where you are. And therefore, you should really consult with whoever the Rav is that you're speaking to, or the family speaking to, wherever the deceased is, to get a better sense of direction of what he feels the custom in that area are. Let me give you a couple different kinds of examples to see what I mean. But that's just to mention. With the location of where you are, where he is, yeah.
The location where, if someone's in Israel,
yeah.
But the mace is in Chutz Laaretz, do you follow the customs of Chutz Laaretz?
So in terms of the immediate aspects, generally speaking, you would follow the customs of Chutz Laaretz. However, this is already gets a little tricky, and this you have to be on the ball with this, and it's kedai to have either a Rav here or there, people that know both sides, because some of the people here that are going to be helping to bury, and what'd you say? Exactly. So they may ask you, they may make certain requests to do it in terms of how they do the tar or other things. They may make very specific requests of how to do it that maybe not everybody in America is going to do, either because that's not their custom, or even worse than that, some of them may not be totally the same types of people. They may not be totally religious or whatever it is. My father pointed out this to me. Again, this is his field, so he's had tons of experience in this, and if he were here, I'd love to get him to speak about this topic. He actually may be visiting us in a couple of weeks. Maybe if anybody's still around a couple of weeks in the summer, into the summer, maybe I'll get him to come give a little bit of a follow-up to some of this stuff. So basically, the way that it is today in the Chutz Laaretz, at least in America, and I don't know about other countries, but a lot of times the funeral home actually takes care of a lot of the arrangements. They often will find either what they would call the Chevra Kaddish or the other parts of preparing the deceased for burial. And sometimes some funeral homes are not really always the one that do from religious funerals. The Rav is really the one that has to be in contact with the funeral home to make sure that they do things the way that they should. Okay? And you have to be on top of that to make sure that it gets done, even if you're not the one who's doing it, but to be in touch with somebody, with a Rav or whatever else, to make sure that the funeral home knows what to do, and they have a religious, some sort of religious rabbi that has some sort of, you know, direction that can tell them what to do properly. Not everybody that does the Tara apparently is always religious, and that's really a problem. The Tara and other aspects of dealing with the dead body are really supposed to be done by somebody who's frum and Yerushalayim and somebody who knows the halachas, etc., etc. Somebody who's been trained to be part of the Chevra Kadisha, and that you need to have, you know, you need to make sure they're on the same page. So all the, for all these reasons, you really have to have people that know what they're doing, and therefore, if it's not you or if it's a Rav, whoever it is that knows how to find the right people, that's very important. Okay. Very, very important in many, many regards. So keep that in mind as well. In terms of just very, you know, basic things, what do you do when the person passes away, Rachmana Litzlan? So the first thing to do is immediately you call either the Rav or the Chevra Kadisha. Okay, that's the first thing you try to do. Again, at some point, obviously, afterwards, you're going to try to notify the family members as well. But sometimes the Chevra Kadisha and the Rav are not immediately accessible that second. So you have to at least try to get them as fast as you can. Okay, and try, you know, to, as best as you can. What'd you say? So that's also true. Again, we'll get to that in a second. All the same things will still apply. If the Rav is in town, then definitely try to go over there, walk to the Rav. You're not allowed to be Mechal Shabbos in order to do any of these preparations. However, you try as best as you can to get them involved. If he's nearby, definitely walk to him and tell him, inform him of what happened and have him, you know, have him guide you. But in the case of my wife, when her father passed away, it was Sunday afternoon and they couldn't reach the rabbi because he was at a wedding. And either he didn't answer his phone, or maybe he did, but the music was too loud and he couldn't hear. Whatever it was, I don't remember the exact details. But they were stuck for a couple hours. They couldn't reach him. But they tried. The point is, they have to try. Now, aside from that, so what else do you do?
Well, I don't know if it's you try as much as you can before, you know, the person.
So that's.
But you try and like straighten like your arms and like to make
okay.
it respectful.
Right. So that's very important. So I found he has a little discussion in Rav Goldman's book here, in the Hebrew one. He actually has a little discussion about this, which is very, very good. The other books, I didn't see that quite as much, maybe a little bit, but he was very good in terms of saying exactly what to do. We're not going to go through all the details right now, but essentially what Gary is describing, you know, is in terms of Kavod HaMeis, basically straightening him out, maybe closing the eyes and a few other things. What'd you say? Yeah, closing the mouth. There's a few things like this that are suggested. Now, he points out there as well, and I'm not sure, I don't know how often this is true, but he points out there, if it's something which is very, very difficult for you to do, especially in that state of mind, he says that it's definitely okay to leave that for the Chevra Kadisha. Okay, meaning if you feel that you just can't, you cannot deal with it at that moment, your mind is just, so then just wait. Okay, wait for them to come and they'll take care of everything. There are some people that say even maybe take the mace and lower him to the ground. There are a few other things that are maybe suggested, but again, these are things which, again, today I think most people is not so widely, you know, accepted to do that. Generally speaking, you wait, maybe just close the eyes and straighten the body a little bit, which are easy things to do, and then put a sheet over the body. That's basically the extent of what most people would do today. But again, you know, that is mentioned. If somebody wanted to do that, that's not bad to do that, or turn the body around so the feet are facing the other direction, whatever. Again, there are a few things that we're not going to get into now, but that's definitely okay to let the Chevra Kadisha take care of that afterwards. So that, what'd you say?
So I was going to say covering mirrors as well.
So that's a house thing. Yeah, I mean, if she passed away in a house, then that's an issue which at some point you should get to. Again, that may not be the first thing you do 2 minutes later, but at some point afterwards, that's definitely meant. I don't know if the women, again, that may be some of the aspects of Shmira, but yeah. Right, so in a hospital it's a little easier because usually you have access to more people, but again, you have to be careful. The best thing to do in a hospital also is try to get, you know, the chaplain to be involved in this rather than the hospital staff if they're not Jewish. Right. That's really not ideal. I think you need a chaplain.
They tend to take it down to the mortuary.
Right. They tend to move it. Yeah, that's, I think Micha's correct. they tend to take it somewhere else. So basically what you really have to push, and this is important if you know already that the end is near, this is good to coordinate with the hospital staff beforehand. And if you have a Jewish chaplain, he's really the go-to person here. My father, by the way, is also a chaplain in addition to, you know, his other duties. He can tell you all of his experiences about this aspect of it as well. But you really have to try to arrange this beforehand if you can. Meaning if you can be in contact with a chaplain, he's the one that can arrange to make sure that as little as possible the hospital staff, either that are not Jewish or not necessarily religious, they can sort of take a back step and let him be in charge. That's really the ideal of how it should be done. If it doesn't work, you can't force them, you can't scream at them, whatever it is, you do the best you can. But really the chaplain is really rabbi, the community rabbi, if he has experience, if he's nearby also, that's why it's best to be in touch with him right away, so they can really, push for at least ideally what the best method of, of having, the religious Jews deal with it as soon as possible. So that's the next point. So that was my next point. So in terms of Shmira, so Shmira is a very, very important halachic concept. If you look at the same source number 3, in Siv Vav in the Shulchan Aruch there. So he mentions this is also based on the Gemara. Hamishamar es hameis, somebody who guards the dead body, afilu she'eino meis, even if it's not your relative. Patra mikriya shma mikol mitzvos amuras b'torah. He's exempt from all the mitzvos. Why is that? Because osif a mitzvah, patra min a mitzvah. If he's in the middle of a mitzvah, he's exempt from other mitzvahs. And the halacha is that somebody who guards the mace, who's the shomer, he is doing a very, very important mitzvah. That is something which is really extremely critical. And the Gemara discusses this as well. We're not going to go into the details now. There are a number of reasons why it's important. In the simple reading of the Gemara, it seems to be that the idea is that we're afraid of decay from insects and mice and things like that. That's what the Gemara mentions. We're afraid that if the dead body is there, then it's going to attract certain things that you don't want to attract. So you need to have a person there to make sure that does not happen. Okay. In addition to that, there are other reasons that are mentioned as well by some of the later sources. And actually, the Rishalmi even mentions one of these things as well, in terms of Bizayon HaMeis, that it's more covered to the deceased to have somebody who's watching them, who's there with them the entire time. Again, the person should ideally be somebody who's Shomer Torah Mitzvos. Okay, you can get paid for it, it can be somebody who's hired, but ideally really should be somebody who's Shomer Torah Mitzvos, and really the best thing to do is for him to be sitting there and saying Tehillim during the entire time that he's there. Again, there are different approaches to that as well, but generally speaking, that's usually what ideally should be done, is really he should be saying Tehillim while he's being the Shomer. What'd you say?
Told him to bring chairs and tables.
Yeah. Correct. That's basically what you should do ideally until the Chavar Kadisha comes in and takes care of the body. Again, well, what they're going to basically do is take the body again, finish being machabed the body by turning it in the right direction, closing the eyes and whatever, and then slowly lowering the body to the floor and taking it out. And basically taking care of the tahara, meaning wherever the place that they're going to end up doing it is, but basically washing the body and putting on the tachrichin, okay, the white shrouds that people generally are buried in, washing, again, cutting the nails, whatever, all the other things that are taken care of during the tahara, which we generally do not do today. It used to be the family did it. Today, the Chavar Kadisha is in charge, so they generally will take care of all these things. So, to be honest, I think they usually will... Would you say? Right, so I think they usually take it away. I don't think they're usually going to do it there. But again, there may be some extenuating circumstances. If for every reason they can't do it somewhere else, they could do it there. But in general, they're going to take it to the place that they usually have to do it, assuming that it's somewhere nearby in the community. They're generally going to do it to their either, again, if it's done through the funeral home, they have a room there that they'll do it in. If it's somewhere else, then they'll have their set place. But I can't say that it never happens in other places. There's definitely, sometimes, once in a while. The other aspect of the Shomer, by the way, is that he's not allowed to eat or to do other types of mitzvos within proximity of the mace. Okay, it's strictly for sitting there and guarding him and saying to him. Again, we're almost out of time, so just very, very quickly here. Yeah. Again, I'm not sure if I understand the question. Yes, ideally you should have somebody else. Somebody else, even if it's not them, some other family member, somebody that's not right there at that moment, taking care of the arrangements outside. The one who's the shomer should really just be there and sitting there and saying to him and not much else. That's basically really the way that ideally should work. Now, what Rav Moshe points out here, and this is an interesting discussion which we don't have time to get into now, but in source number 5, basically the question Rav Moshe was asked is, let's say that it's a case where you're not worried about mice. The example he gives here is if the mace is in a coffin. Okay, which again, if it's in a room, if it's already not, you know, it's out of wherever the person died and you've already taken care of and moved it somewhere else, you know, if the mace is in a coffin, so then there's absolutely no way that a mouse is going to get into the coffin. The shaila is, do you need a shomer? So Rav Moshe, again, we don't have time to read the whole thing inside, but it's not hard Hebrew, you can try to read it inside. Basically, what he basically says here, based on the sugyas in the Gemara, is essentially that the obligation for the shomer to be constant is only true if there's a concern for mice. If there's no chashash achbarim, because let's say they're in a coffin, so then he says, basically, that you do not have to be there every moment. You still need to have a shomer, and he proves that from the Gemara as well. That the shomer, the Gemara talks about that he can go out to say, to say Kriya Shema or Shmon Esrei or whatever, but it sounds like he's still supposed to be there the rest of the time. But Moshe says you do need to have a shomer for whatever reason it is, either because of Kavod Ames, okay, for his dignity, whatever other things it might be. But he says that type of shomer is permitted to be what we call Yotzei V'Nichnas. He can go in and out. So if that was the situation, okay, he's in a coffin, so then already would be permitted to go out for a few minutes to make a call arrangement or talk to somebody about important matters, etc., etc., and then to go back in a few minutes later. That would be permitted. Ideally, the best thing to do is have somebody there the whole time, but if you have a situation where there's no chashash for acharim or other things like that, then according to Rav Moshe, he feels that it is permitted to be in and out. You don't have to be there every single second. Okay? All right. Any other quick questions before we just conclude with the last one or two aspects? Again, if you have to leave, you can leave. Otherwise, we'll do another 5 to 10 minutes or so. Okay. Okay. The other things I was just going to mention is the following. Very briefly, there are some that have minhagim, which are, again, for many, many, already for a long time. Number one, some people have minhag of opening the windows so the neshama can fly out of the window. That's mentioned in many, many places. Opening the windows. So again, not everybody does this, but it's a nice custom to do, and it's definitely mentioned by some people originally in the Ma'avar Yabok, which is one of these sarim that deals with a lot of these different kinds of interesting things, to open the windows. So he mentions, Rav Goldman also mentions that in there, and most of the sarim mention it as well. But it's not practiced by everybody, so it's not an obligation. That's not, you know, it's not required. Another thing which is mentioned, which is not so practiced today either, which is pouring out the water in different, in a place in the house and houses nearby. That already in most places today is really not so practiced, except if you're, you know, into Kabbalah or Sardim, whatever, Hasidish, what'd you say? The concept seems to have been that, and this is already mentioned in the poskim, that maybe the water was contaminated when a person dies. So basically any water that's already there would be contaminated, or in the house next door on one side or on the other side. Today many people do not miss that, and even people that do, many of them will say that, well, if it's in a faucet, it's fine. But if you actually have water that's out, so that already, if you wanted to be machmir for that, so then, you know, you would say maybe get rid of that water. But again, it's not, many people do not practice that today. That's not the most important, you know, required thing. But it's certainly mentioned in many, many sources. So, certainly here in Eretz Yisrael, I think both of these points are probably more practiced here than in Chutz Laretz. That's my impression. Again, on Shabbos, we mentioned before, don't move the mace. That's very, very important. The mace is mukta. So you're not allowed to actually move the body itself. Okay? That's again, maybe put a sheet over it, whatever else. Would you say? So basically, you leave it. What you could do, and this is what some people suggest, is that if you're afraid that it's going to be, you know, it's going to start to decompose a little bit, it's hot or whatever it is, so maybe to ask a non-Jew to bring some, so turn on the air conditioning or a fan or something like that, just to be near the mace, or ask the non-Jew to move the body to a place where it will be cooler. That's an option. But to have a Jew do it is generally not allowed. So that also, moving parts of the body generally also, again, if you have a goy there, so the goy, I guess in this case, maybe it should not be done. But generally speaking, contact on the mace should be avoided. Okay.
Once I had to do shmira and the body was sort of sitting in a chair, covered in a talis, and it was on a front. We were students Friday at the time, and someone said, well, you do shmira. So we were like, okay, fine. So off we went, and the body's there, covered in a talus in the corner, literally sitting. And they said, oh, no, we can't straighten it.
Wow. That's basically, yeah, that's the halacha.
But the mortis was setting in.
Some people should be breathing.
So that's also a whole discussion, which I wasn't going to get into now. But, right. That's a, you know. today, again, there used to be other ways they used to check. They used to take the body on the floor and leave it there for 20 minutes. Today, basically, you say a doctor checks, says he's, you know, that's it. And that's all, that's really all that... So again, I don't want to get into this now because it's already a little more complicated, but basically there's a concept of kikar or chinuk, that if you put a piece of bread on top of the dead body, then you may be allowed to move the body with the bread on top because you're moving it for the bread, you know, moving the bread and not the body. But again, these are already getting some more complicated halachas, which I didn't really want to get into right now, just for lack of time and, you know. If the person's already passed away, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Where are they going to be?
If
they think there's a chance of, something, then they could take him. For sure, that's mutter. But even if he stopped breathing, if there's a chance of, you know, pumping him back up again, for sure. But other than that, better not. It's better to leave him. Okay.
The ambulance fund is called to a person that's dead. The ambulance will usually arrange or make some effort for a doctor to confirm that the person is
right.
I've been called a couple of times after the ambulance have attended to a person, say, this happened to me and Kibbutz Ein Sorim. They said we need you to certify. They were called to the patient.
Right. That's what's generally done if possible. Right. Okay, let's go on. We're have another couple minutes. One other point to just mention, and it's not usually done today, but Tzidut HaDin and Kriya, which maybe Rav Orlin will hopefully discuss next week a little bit. But Tzidut HaDin is a paragraph that you say, basically justifying that Hashem is just, even if we can't say it. It's in all the sections here, all the books and different parts. We're not going to go through it now. But that and then tearing Kriya, tearing the garment that you're wearing. So these, the strict halachas, actually those are done at the time of the death, okay, by the relatives and maybe even by the people that are standing there. However, the generally accepted custom today in most places, we don't do that. We rather wait until shortly before the actual levaya, before the actual funeral, in order to do those things. There are various reasons for that, either because emotionally you're not in the right state when the person passes away, or you may not know how to do it properly, so you want to wait till there's a rav or somebody there to guide you, etc. If you did it at the time of the Misa, that's absolutely valid, completely legitimate. But again, today, most people, the generally accepted practice is not to do it then, to wait till later, in most cases. But again, just be aware that is an issue that comes up, and just to know what they are, we'll discuss them hopefully more next week. The Tzidut HaDin, the paragraph we say, and then the Kriya, the tearing of the garment. That's basically what I wanted to mention for the other aspects of after the person passes away. Just a very quick word about cremation, and then I'll just conclude. Cremation, again, unfortunately today is on the rise. In America, I think these days, I don't know in other countries, in America I think it's already up to almost 30% of people that want to be cremated. Apparently, from the stats that I saw, in the western states, in the west coast area, apparently in some places it could be up to 70%. Apparently people think, number one, that it's cheaper, which it actually might be. Would you say? That's the secular world. In the Jewish world, I don't know what the stats are, but unfortunately the rate is certainly rising because of the secular world, the rate is rising, and the Jewish world also. It may be cheaper. That's one issue, which apparently may be, you know, definitely may be a consideration. But other than that, people think that it's maybe environmentally better, etc. It's purer, it's cleaner. Whatever it is, I'm not sure that's necessarily correct. By the way, there's a whole literature about this also. You can look online, you can look up all the information about that. But at the end of the day, in terms of the Torah perspective, today, again, I would say the following. I would say that the vast majority, today almost universally, earlier when it began, whenever this was, about 200 years ago, it was the vast majority of opinions, and today it's almost universally the accepted opinion is that it's completely wrong. Okay, that the Torah perspective is that this is not something that we do. So I didn't want to get into this now. Again, you want to get into history. Apparently, when the idea of cremation actually was conceived in the machine, came up by either the late 1700s or the early 1800s. I forgot exactly when it was, but you can find all the information online. I can show you where I found it. Apparently, there were some rabbanim in certain countries in Europe that actually felt that maybe it wasn't so bad. Okay, and England was actually one of the places that they thought it wasn't so bad, believe it or not. You can look at the, there's some information online. So, right, again, I'm not going to get into the details now. The bottom line is that many rabbanim argued with them, especially in Germany at the time, And today, it's again been basically universally accepted today that the halacha is that we do not do this. Okay, and there are a lot of reasons that are given by many different types of poskim. Again, we're not going to go into it all right now. I copied for you here a little bit from the Chabad.org. I'm not usually into quoting these kind of websites for these kind of shiurim, but here is just the easiest thing to summarize. And I didn't even quote the whole article. If you look at the link there, you can find you can Google it online. You find the whole article, like 10 pages long. He's got a very nice summary of a lot of different reasons. Again, obviously it's a summary. The best thing would be to read all the chews inside, which I would have done if there was time and if I had space on the page, but of course I didn't. Essentially, the different ideas here, number one, is that there's a mitzvah of kvura. Okay, there's a mitzvah of burial, and that's understood by most opinions to mean that you actually have to bury the body in the ground. Okay, that is the idea of kavod ames, and therefore to get rid of the body in any other way is completely wrong. Okay. In addition to that, in addition to the idea of kavod ames, the idea of tchias amesim is mentioned by some as being the idea that perhaps tchias amesim cannot take place if there's no body to resurrect or no bones to resurrect. The idea that the body itself is a holy object. The body is what carried the neshama in it, that the person served God for so many years, and just to get rid of the body is completely anti the idea of respect for the body, aside from any issue of kavura. But just the idea of taking a body and just getting rid of, making it into ashes, is totally not in line with Jewish tradition. There are a number of interesting chews about this as well, which again, if you wanted to see the Shridi Esh, Rav Chil Yaakov Weinberg has a whole tshuva about it. He talks about doing a tahara for somebody who was cremated beforehand. That was his shala. He was asked the Lama Bahoil or David Tzvi Hoffman, who was in Germany, also before, a little earlier than Shridi Esh. He discusses the question of whether you can bury the ashes of somebody who was cremated in the Jewish cemetery. So that was actually machlokas, a poskim, a very big machlokas at the time, whether that's allowed. Meaning nobody said, from that machlokas, those people did not say that it was okay. The question was, though, can you bury the ashes in a Jewish cemetery? That was a major, major machlokas. There are other discussions as well. Again, the bottom line is that it's generally, this is very, very strongly disapproved of by poskim today. And therefore, again, if it comes up, if you see that it's an issue, it's something that you really, really have to try to discourage. The halacha actually would be, according to these poskim, is that even if the person told you they want to be cremated, if you have any say in the matter, you're actually not supposed to do that. Meaning, even though usually we do follow the requests of the mace beforehand, before he died, if he requested certain things, we try to comply. For this issue, we're not supposed to comply. You don't listen, and you give him a proper Jewish burial, because we assume that once he gets up to Shemayim, once he realizes what really was supposed to happen, ideally what he was supposed to do, we assume that he would be happy retroactively if you give him a proper Jewish burial. That's what we usually assume. Okay, however, unfortunately, it's not always in your control. And this I know already from one or two people that had this situation here in Yad Binyamin, whose relatives passed away, and from other places as well. My father, unfortunately, gets this very commonly. This is something he's involved in a lot. He doesn't like it, obviously, but unfortunately, many people do want to be cremated, and sometimes, the rest of the family, let's say, is not religious, and they're fine with it. And let's say there's one, traditional or religious sibling or child or whatever it is, and they're the only ones that wanted to avoid the cremation. And basically they try, and they basically can't convince the person to change his mind before he passes away, and they can't convince the rest of their family to change their mind as well. So what do you do? So essentially, again, you try your best, you really try, you try to argue with them, you try to, not argue, but you try to explain to them nicely some of these different concerns. You give them some literature to read to understand a little bit more of the background of why it's important to not be cremated. And if they just don't give in, then if there's nothing you can do, if you can't force them and you can't, then you have to let it go. However, then the shaila becomes, well, what do you do afterwards? So again, today, basically the way that it works is perhaps a little different than it worked at the time. Meaning, let's say 200 years ago in Germany and other places where most people that wanted to be cremated essentially had, they were going against tradition, meaning most of the community was religious, and these people felt they're the Reformed Jews, they're the ones that are specifically intentionally going against what they should be doing. So in that situation, many poskim felt that these people are considered what they call Porish Midarchei Atzibur. These were the evil, wicked people, and most people in the halacha, they talk about those people not even getting a proper burial. That's one issue. You can't bury them with the rest of the religious Jews in the cemetery. You got to bury them somewhere else. So that already today we don't do anymore. That today we never ever do that to any Jew. We assume that, well, maybe in his last minute he did tshuva, maybe he didn't know better, etc., etc. Here, though, for this issue, there's still a bit of a debate about it, because one can argue that, obviously, if to his last day, the last moment, he wanted to be cremated against what the Torah says, then obviously he never did tshuva, and maybe you still have to treat him like somebody who separated himself from the rest of the community. And therefore, there are poskim, certainly in the original poskim, and maybe even today as well, some poskim say, therefore, because of that, you again, don't do a tahara beforehand. Some people say you shouldn't say Kaddish, some people say you shouldn't say Shiva, no Anilas, no nothing. Some people say based on that as well that you shouldn't, as we said before, shouldn't put the ashes in the cemetery. The question is today, most of the people that we or others like us would be in contact with are probably people whose families were not religious and didn't really have anything to do with a religious context. They didn't know any better. And therefore, in that situation, this is a very sticky issue. How do you follow the rules in a situation of a person who himself or his family or her family was not familiar, they didn't grow up, and they didn't live with a Torah lifestyle. And therefore, yes, they know about Orthodox Jews, but they themselves don't understand and appreciate why cremation is so bad. So there already there are different opinions about what to do. Some of them will say, no, you still shouldn't sit, you shouldn't do anything, you can't bury the ashes in the cemetery even if they want to, you shouldn't say Kaddish, you shouldn't sit Shiva, etc., etc., etc. And there are others that say, well, maybe we can find ways to sort of do it. And here already, this is very important to speak to your Rav, because different Rabbanim have different opinions about this. And it may also depend on the situation of exactly who the person was, and what was explained to him, and etc., etc., etc. Very important to get some guidance about this issue. The cases that my father has done, and some of them that I've been familiar with, there often was room to say that certainly to say Kaddish was definitely okay, as well as maybe some aspect of sitting Shiva and having Avelus. Now, again, maybe some people would say some of the aspects of Shiva you shouldn't do. Some people would say maybe for Avelus, for Shloshim and Yud Bet Chodesh and all those kind of things, maybe if you do it, it's not real, okay, and you're doing it as a Chumrah just to do it, but it's not really required. Maybe you're doing it because you don't want other people to know about it. This is a serious concern as well. You don't want the entire world knowing that your parent, God forbid, or somebody else, you know, wanted to be cremated. That's a little bit embarrassing. So for that reason, you might say, well, I want to keep the Avelus anyway. And in that case, maybe it's okay. It's not problematic to keep all the aspects of Avelus. But at the same time, if there are specific issues that come up, you speak to a Rav, and again, I've been involved in this case already a number of times, there's room to be mekil in that situation. If something comes up, they say, well, this is really important to me, and I'm sitting Shiva or Shloshim or I want to go to a simcha, whatever it is, and it's really hard to not go. Well, if you're not really seeing an official Shiva, then or official Shloshim, maybe there's more room to be makil. Very important to get a bit of guidance about all these different points, again, because each case is different, and each Rav may have a different opinion as well. Yeah?
I'm just curious about what the main line of reasoning is for not sitting Shiva.
It's the same idea, that basically he separated himself from the sea, where he's obviously somebody that to his last day, he is not he's not somebody that keeps halacha. And therefore keeps the Torah, and therefore he's not subject to the regular rules. Again, the regular rule of that is in the Shulchan Aruch, just we don't usually follow it for most people. So the question is, today, is this person like most people that weren't from? Or is this person different because even to his last day, there's never ever any chance, he never did tshuva because he requested to have something done to his body, which is absolutely, you know, incompatible with the halacha the way we understand it today. But again, some poskim say today it's the same thing. He just didn't know. He didn't know any better. Nobody explains him. And even if you tried to explain to him, he didn't get it. He didn't appreciate. You know, he didn't grow up. He didn't live the religious lifestyle that you lived. So you just can't possibly, you know, incorporate it the way that maybe you would. And therefore, again, you know, some would say that maybe you can sit Shiva and can, you know, depends on.
I had a question.
Okay, we'll have to just finish up here. Maybe we'll save the questions to the end. Let me just conclude. And then happy to stick around. But just so people can leave if you want. Just to conclude, again, the ideas that we've discussed here is just an overview. We have not discussed every single halacha inside and that all every single application, but at least we have some basic understanding of what's going on here. Again, as we've seen, the emotions behind this are incredibly strong when you're going through it, and you will not remember every single thing that we talked about tonight. That is for sure guaranteed. But the idea is you'll be at least somewhat familiar with it to know a little bit about it, and you'll know, you'll remember that, you know, when you hopefully turn, and you must turn for rabbinic guidance, it'll be not completely in a vacuum, you'll have some sort of context for it when it comes up. I just mentioned that in terms of the rabbi, the rabbi's rule, my father discusses this extensively in his book, very important. It's very important for the rabbi to be there, not just in terms of halacha, but the rabbi also, because of his context, as a comforter and somebody to be giving the guidelines, is often a comforting presence for the family. Okay, the very fact that he's there and taking part in his care and concern and his guidelines gives a little bit of a structure to what's happening that really is helpful for the family in a way that they can't always put into words. And I've seen this in communities here and elsewhere, and growing up, you know, with, you know, seeing my father come and being there some of the time, you can't express how important that is, both from the halakhic perspective as well as from the psychological perspective and the pastoral perspective for the rabbi, the presence to be there, whoever that is, and to be involved, really, really important. So make sure that you have somebody that can do that. And finally, if you're there, not just as a relative, but on the friend side, okay, the community support is also very important. However, and my father writes about this as well, during the time of Aninus, the community sort of takes a back seat. During the period of an onan, the person is not really ready to deal with the community yet. Right at that point, they're in the middle of grief, and they're in the middle of all they need is their very, very close family and maybe very close friends just to help them out a little bit. At that point, all you can do as a close friend or supporter, I think, is really just show that you're there. Just be there. You don't have to do anything. Don't come and start making condolence visits. Don't come and make a whole spiel. It's not the right time for doing that. That's for the Shiva. During the Aninus, again, it's close family, obviously, and friends, if you feel that you can be helpful in any way in terms of arrangements or other things, you know, certainly for your assistance in any way to drive people from the airport or to help with the arrangements for the funeral, whatever it might be, in any way that could be helpful, certainly to offer your support and just say, and just be there. Just to be there, that is all that you can do, and that is the most important thing, I think, from my experience and from what I know, for people during this stage of grief, because at this point, most people are not really ready yet to confront the community and to go out there. They don't want to talk to anybody. They just have to deal with it themselves and with their family. But in terms of the practical arrangements for the funeral, that's something that they have to be involved in. They must be, because there's no other way. And that, again, by itself helps them work through their feelings and to put some sort of practical way of directing their feelings into something productive. And if that's something that you can be helpful at as a friend or whatever it is, that's certainly a way to work with it. And hopefully we shouldn't need any of these halakhas at any point, but hopefully we also can get some schus and some comfort through learning through them, either before or after. And Hashem should protect us from having to deal with this.
I wanted to just add in a few things that maybe weren't entirely clear or could be added on to a little bit from the shir. Number one. We discussed a little bit during this year that generally speaking, the tahara and the moving of the mace is generally supposed to be done by religious Jews from individuals, Yirei Shamayim, etc. This is mentioned in a number of the Sfarim, and the Achronim, the Kolbo of Greenwald in his Sefer on Avelis. So he brings this down extensively. And this is generally what's done, assuming that it's desired here in Eretz Yisrael. They have plenty of chevra kadishas that take care of these things, and generally is not a problem. In Chutz Laaretz, especially in the United States, just mentioned, and I think this didn't get mentioned sufficiently in the shir, that's not always the case. My father, Rabbi Joseph Ozarowski, who again is this is his field, so he reports. That in his experience, most of the times that somebody dies in a healthcare facility, hospital, whatever, it's very, very difficult to allow a chevra kadisha or from Jews to be able to transport the body or to take the body or do anything with it. Generally, they're not certified in order to be able to do that, with some exceptions in the New York area, but in general, not. And the best thing that they can do, he says, in his experience as chaplain, is at least in the hospital to train the hospital staff to, at the very least, to be to retain the blood and whatever blood may be around in post-mortem fluids and things like that, to at least retain that with the body to be buried together, because according to the halacha, you have to bury all parts of the body and all fluids from the body together. That's one important thing that if the chaplain is around or whatever, generally should be would be best for them to train the hospital staff that's taking care of the body to be able to do that. In addition to that, in terms of even the tahara and the pickup of the body, so most of the time today, what happens, at least in the United States, is that the funeral home is in charge of these aspects, and the funeral home sends different people to pick up the body and to take care of the tahara and whatever else. If that's the situation, then ideally the best thing to do is check beforehand, and you may need to check with your rabbi if this is taking place in Chutz Laaretz, to help you out, but find one of the funeral homes that has at the very least one or one religious Jew, or even Jews in general, and especially if you can get religious Jews, that would obviously be really the way that it should be, to get the funeral homes that employ some of those, because a lot of them are not necessarily employing Jews and not necessarily religious Jews. So that would be the best. But it's an important thing which does not always take place today in the United States, that that's just the way that it is. So one should be aware of that, and you know, to whatever degree possible, to try to go to the places that do have options of having at least one religious Jew there to help out and to transport the body and to take care of preparing the body for burial. That's point. That's the first point. Point number two, in terms of Shabbos. So we mentioned that generally speaking, the body is not moved on Shabbos. The body is muktza. Again, we mentioned the only time that the body can be moved is if you put something on top of kikar or tinok. You put something, even a piece of bread or something on top of the body that would allow you to move the body because of the thing that's on top. So there are different customs. This is also brought down in some of the svarim. There are different customs for exactly what's done if you need to move the body to the floor or somewhere else to be at least to be cooled off or to not be hot or to take off the clothing because it's going to perspire and begin to decompose or to rot, decay, whatever it is. So that there are some that do allow that for the mesa's sake in that regard. That maybe it is permitted to take a garotinoke or whatever and move the body to the floor or take off the clothes or whatever it is. But many others do not allow that, and in many places that's the practice is not to do anything to the body on Shabbos, just to put on a sheet, and certainly not to do anything else to any other limbs of the body, which is generally muksa. That would not be allowed. The last thing I wanted to mention, which in the shiur itself there wasn't really time for, and we're not really going to get to this in detail, just simply because there's a lot of things to discuss, and this is we decided to not get into this topic. But basically, at the time of death, what is supposed to take place, ideally at the time of death, or right before the time of death, essentially, the main thing that's supposed to be done is really to say vidwig, and there are a lot of other practices people talk about as well. It's not always possible, depending on where you are and the status of the mental state of the person who's about to die, but ideally the halacha has mentioned that really he should be saying bidui, and that basically whoever's around him should encourage him to say the bidui, to confess. Again, the Shulchan Aruch discusses how that one should do this, ideally to say that many people have confessed and said bidui and then have recuperated, so the person shouldn't get too scared. It's not necessarily that he's going to die, but ideally, certainly before death, the bidui should be said, at least for the last time. If he can't do it himself, so then whoever's with him can help him say it. They could say it for him, with him listening, whatever the case is. That's ideal. There are plenty of other customs of other psukim to say as well. Towards the end, some people talk about saying nishmas kol chai alokai neshama, mikel kamocha psukim en micha yivrecha Hashem yishmorecha, the brecha for the kohanim, all sorts of other things that are custom that some people have the custom to say. So these are all, again, mentioned by different minhagim, but again, the vidui is really the key part to keep in mind if one should ever find himself in that situation, and whatever can be done in that regard. Just conclude again that hopefully we should never have to use these halachos, and we should only be zocha to good times, but when these things happen, when we go through the process of death for somebody in the family, this should be remembered clearly that this is not necessarily the end as we see it, but it actually may be the beginning of a whole new stage. There's a very interesting comment in the Zohar in Parshas Noach, which basically translates as follows, that what is death exactly? Death is the taking off, the shedding of one garment and donning another garment. This was by Haim. So he wrote one of the famous Sfarim in Hilchos Avelos. So he himself used to say that very very often, that the idea of death is just taking off what you're wearing now and putting on something else. Basically, your neshama turns into something totally bodiless, without a body, and really a totally different existence is what's moved onto by the neshama, that we should take that as a little bit of comfort, that obviously, even though their time on this earth is done, they're in a much better place, and they are doing other things in other ways than we could do at this time. Thank you.